Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we dedicate our stories to elders, grandparents, and family members who came before us.
Some people called on the phone. What time is your appointment? Mine's 2:45. Our friend, the dentist, he was 3:30. And it was like a social event.
It's a small island. A lot of them I knew when I was a kid. So it was, you know, to really help them feel like they weren't alone.
It's partly this communal nature of food, and so it can operate as a bridge, not just between neighbors and friends, but also between the living and the dead.
Listen to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And the other day, well, actually, it wasn't the other day. Funny how time has flown. It was probably in early summer, let's say June, you know, the height of this past COVID season and weird quarantines. And I was rummaging around in the back of my liquor cabinet looking for something to make an interesting cocktail with. Cocktails, right, because I drink cocktails all the time. No, this was like middle of the week. I don't know. But anyway, I was rummaging around looking for something, and I came across an old bottle of Pimm's that a friend had brought me. I don't know. She had been to England, and she had loved the Pimm's cup, and she said, oh, this will be fun. I'll bring it up for the summertime. We'll have a Pimm's cup. Then I was thinking, but why am I looking for something to make a cocktail with? I'm really a wine drinker. And then I thought to myself, well, of course, cocktails are festive. And, well, I think my husband and I really needed something to lift our spirits. Things were getting kind of glum. And then I happened to think about the term spirits. Well, you know how the mind goes. I was starting to spin around. And then I thought, but that's interesting. Lift my spirits. And yet we call these alcoholic drink spirits. But then I found out, interestingly enough, that spirit in reference to alcohol is from Middle Eastern alchemy and probably from the medieval times, I think around 14th century. But it was, you know, they were concerned with, you know, making medical elixirs and so the evaporation of the alcohol or distillation of the alcohol was actually called a spirit as it was, you know, flowing up and probably a, you know, this ghostly looking, you know, stuff coming off of it. Anyway, that was how my mind was working then. But then back to the Pimm's, I was thinking, what is Pimm's anyway? And then I realized I knew who I needed to talk to, my friend Kara Newman. Kara is a spirits and cocktail writer based in New York. And I've known Kara for, well, I was thinking it was about 15 years. Now I'm thinking it was more like 20 years. She is the spirits editor for Wine Enthusiast. And her writing has appeared in publications, including the Wall Street Journal and New York Times and the Washington Post and the Atlantic and Bloomberg Business Week. Oh, by the way, she started out as a business writer. Mm-hmm. So she knows the business also of spirits. She was the founder and curator of the Drink Think literary reading series. Kara is also the author of 6 cocktail books, for which she's been on my show a couple of times, I think. She's written Cocktails with a Twist, Nightcap, Shake, Stir, and Sip, all from Chronicle Books. And there's Cocktails for a Crowd, Spice and Ice, Road Soda. And her first book, The Secret Financial Life of Food. Kara won the IACP prestigious Burt Green Award in 2013, and She was also the recipient of the 2014 Farniente Winery Fellowship at the Symposium for Professional Wine Writers at Meadowood. Kara knows her spirits, and she knows how to write. Welcome, Kara.
Hi, Linda.
All right, so you heard my whole rant about PIMS. What is PIMS anyway?
Well, PIMS is, it's a lot of fun to drink. It's certainly one of those required drinks for making a PIMS cup for drinking at Wimbledon while you're watching tennis.
Right.
But it has a really long history. I mean, at heart, it's a gin-based herbal liqueur, and it's got a little bit of bitterness from quinine, sort of like a tonic water type bitterness. It has a little bit of fruit, you know, a little bit of herbs, a sort of rosy, ready rosy in color. And it's not too high in alcohol. So it's just really, you know, easy drinking.
There was something for a while. I don't know if it's still on the bottle or not, but I had read that there was an announcement, public service announcement. Do not attempt to drink PIMS neat.
I don't know why. I think it's better mixed. I don't think wrong with drinking
I've sipped it. It certainly doesn't taste good neat. I mean, if you have to put something in it, some lemonade or some bubbly water or bubbly, something to mix it
with. I like it mixed with ginger ale.
Ah, okay.
And as many garnishes as possible.
Right. Well, that, don't they often call it a fruit cup?
Yeah, the PIMS cup. I mean, that's really how the whole PIMS got started. Unlike some drinks where there's no actual person behind it, like the Harvey Wallbanger, there is no Harvey Wallbanger, no such person.
But there is a PIM.
There is. Well, there was James PIM. He was a London fishmonger. And in the 1840s, he established a chain of oyster houses called PIM's Oyster Warehouse. And you can imagine at the time there were oyster houses all over the place. And to make his a bit different, he created his own drink called the PIM's House Cup, which later became PIM's Number One.
Right. And then after that time, there were PIM's Number Two and Three and Four.
All the way up to five.
Wow.
And a bunch of others with no numbers at all.
So this was back in the 1840s. Wow. And it stayed around. I know it's a very, you read in literature, someone will even mention back, like something from the early 1900s. They'll always be mentioning taking a break and having a libation of a PIMS cup. It became superbly popular. Right?
Oh, yeah. And he actually managed to eventually merchandise it and bottle it. The original he would sell in pewter tankards. But then later, as he merchandised the PIMS Oyster Warehouse into warehouses, and there were plenty more, eventually he bottled PIMS. I like to think of it as the first ready-to-drink cocktail. That was in 1865.
And of course, lately there have been a lot of other ready-to-drink cocktails hitting the market. So that's interesting. That was a ready-to-drink cocktail, as you say, like a ready-to-drink cocktail. And now we've got a lot of canned cocktails. You've recently written about that, about the RTDs, ready-to-drink canned cocktails.
Oh, yeah, there's so many of them now. It's funny because I remember I was in London a few years ago, long before we had a lot of ready-to-drink cocktails here, and they were actually selling in the train station canned PIMS and tonics. I was like, wow, why can't we have that? And now we kind of do.
All right. And the first time, I was in the wine store and they were advertising, well, it's a wine and liquor store, and they had these cans. They were advertising cans at the counter. I guess it was last year or something. I really wasn't aware of it prior to that. And
oh, yeah. Big business.
Big, huge business. Yeah. Is there any there? So there's no precedent for us to have any kind of cocktails and can. Well, that is, the industry is just so strict on what can be bottled and canned or canned?
Well, until recently, it just wasn't very, very good. I believe that there were restrictions around what could go into cans and where they could be sold. I know in in a grocery stores, for example, you can't sell distilled spirits in many states. It's all a state-by-state patchwork mm-hmm. in the United States. Mm-hmm. But that's why you can go to the supermarket and you'll find cocktail-flavored malt liquor beverages, because those are not technically distilled spirits and they're below a certain alcohol by volume level, and you can find them all over the place. Hmm. But certainly in recent years, it has become big business. There's less of a stigma around canned or bottled or pre-made drinks being not very good. Now, a lot of them actually are quite good. Lots of them are made by bartenders or backed by big spirits brands. And I mean, they've proliferated, and a lot of distilleries, especially during the pandemic, have switched over to even being canneries, and they're canning on behalf of other entities, you know, bars and restaurants and other distilleries.
Huh. That's really, I find that fascinating. I remember when, you know, there were, strawberry wine mixture way back in the day, you know, different kind of bottled, it seemed like pre-mixed things. And then came some hard seltzer, of course, hard cider. Well, you mentioned, malt liquor. Well, hard cider is not a distilled beverage, so that's okay. You can have that, right? That could be canned and sold. This is a whole new thing. And cocktails. Why cocktails? And because for a while there, I guess maybe about 5 years ago, there was this big resurgence of some of the classic cocktails. You'd see a lot of that in the, in bars that bartenders were getting into mixing, Manhattans and old fashions. And kind of the question is, which came first, that resurgence of classic cocktails or the cocktails in the can? Well, certainly the resurgence of the classic cocktails, I would imagine, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely the resurgence of cocktails. Yeah. I mean, because that really dates back to the early to mid-aughts. That's really when we first started seeing, speakeasy culture come back and the classic cocktails really come back. And the whole canned cocktail wave, that's really quite recent. That's, I'd say, the last couple of years.
And speaking of speakeasy, one of Heritage Radio Network's podcast hosts created a canned cocktail. Souther Teague, he has his own canned cocktail, or at least named after him, that I saw on one of the sites.
Oh, that's through Livewire, I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. It is. It's the Livewire brand, I think. Mm-hmm.
I was just in his general store at Amoria Margo just last weekend, and that's a fun little candy land.
Oh, I'm going to have to check that out.
There's an entire cooler full of bottled, ready-to-drink cocktails. I walked out with a bottle of a pre-made 8 Amaro Sazerac, and it was delightful.
Hmm. Now, Sazerac, that's another, speaking of Pim's Cup, Sazerac, I mean, that's a whole other one of those kind of enigma drinks, like, what is it and what's in it, but you can tell me what's in that.
Oh, in a Sazerac?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's rye whiskey.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's rye whiskey. Usually that's an absinthe rinsed glass. Peychaud's bitters because, New Orleans, you got to have your New Orleans heritage in there. It's, little bit of simple syrup or sugar to kind of sweeten it. And there's some versions where it's cognac instead of rye whiskey.
Yes. But if you go to the Sazerac bar in New Orleans, you're going to get, the classic, the Sazerac, right? I don't understand whether the Sazerac bar came before the drink or after the drink. Was it invented at the bar? I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of mystery around who invented it. Mm-hmm. There's actually, there are a lot of different origin stories for the Sazerac, that's for sure. Let's see, if you really want to get into it, I actually just talked with somebody just a couple of weeks ago about the Sazerac. I can tell you all about that in just a pinch.
I love to go deep. I love to dive deep into this. So yeah, I didn't even think about the Sazerac until you mentioned it. So that was something we didn't prep for here. And I would love to know.
Well, I mean, it goes back to like the, like everything else, it goes back to the 1800s. Everything around here is 1800s on this side of the Atlantic. I mean, I can talk more about Pimm's. I mean, that has a much longer history because England has a much longer history than the United States.
Right. And Sazerac it's a U.S. drink. It was invented in New Orleans. And it's an American cocktail.
Yeah. I mean, it's given New Orleans roots.
Yeah.
But there are just so many different variations of it. I mean, the traditional version, you have like the sugar cube and it's muddled with a splash of water to break apart the sugar cube. And then you've got a bit of Peychaud's with that, measure in a couple of ounces of rye whiskey and, you know, you're good to go.
Hmm.
A lot of the time you'll find Herb Saint is the herbal liqueur that's used to coat the glass because that's a New Orleans product, but it's still that same herbal, or it might be Pernod. It might be absinthe.
Huh. Yeah. Herb Saint definitely is a New Orleans thing. Yeah. Interesting. Well, this whole thing about cocktails and lifting your spirits. I mean, there. I know that I had read in one of the articles you recently wrote that the Distilled Spirits Council had said yes. There's an uptick in spirit sales at this time, and. They, and you mentioned that they had attributed the shift to the stuck-at-home consumer, as much as I spoke about at the beginning of the show. What can you, I mean, do you see that COVID has really created more of a drinking culture?
I think it's been a source of amusement for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially in the early days of the pandemic, a lot of people really were just stuck at home. Making their quarantinis. I mean, that's really going to go down in history, I think.
Right, quarantinis, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, make your quarantinis. And, you know, what was there to do? You could watch Stanley Tucci on Instagram making a Negroni with questionable techniques, some said. I don't mean to trash Stanley Tucci. We love
him. And I know you are a Negroni purist, yes.
I love a good Negroni.
Yeah.
But, you know, there wasn't really a whole lot to do, and liquor stores were open. They were deemed an essential business. So a lot of people really dug in and relearned how to make cocktails at home.
And I think that's interesting that of all things, you know, of course, the liquor business was an essential business. Of course, because we all needed that cocktail to lift our spirits, of course. You couldn't go out to bars, you couldn't go to restaurants, you couldn't do anything, so... That's interesting. Yes, go learn how to make more cocktails at home.
Yeah, I think that sales really shifted from on-premise in bars to off-premise sales, you know, retail at home.
Yeah. And do you think that there was a lot of discovery of classic cocktails? Were people inventing their own, or any indication in any way that you would know?
From what I've seen, it's a lot of rediscovery of classics. There seems to be a real surge in sales of tequila and mezcal. A lot of new celebrity tequila brands, and that's really given everything a real shot in the arm. And mezcal's kind of soared on the back of tequila. People looking for more interesting agave spirits, different agave spirits.
Interesting.
And then I think as we've kind of moved out of quarantine and slowly moving back into restaurant and bars again, what I'm hearing is that everyone's ready for something new and different. I think we're about to see a real explosion of really interesting, complex cocktails, like really crazy ones, because everyone wants what they couldn't make for themselves at home.
Huh, right. It's interesting that what they couldn't make at home... Why couldn't they? Well, lack of imagination or lack of available products.
Well, I don't know what your home bar looks like. I mean, I hear you have Pimm's. Maybe you made the most fabulous Pimm's cup in the world. I honestly only had a handful of of bottles in my home bar, and it kind of limits what you can make. I mean, I don't have the 8 Amaros to make an 8 Amaro Sazerac. So I'm pretty happy to go to Amore Amargo and buy an 8 Amaro Sazerac and take it home and try it there. Yeah. And I'll be perfectly happy when I feel safe doing so to go out to a bar and order, you know, a 12 Amaro Sazerac or, wow. you know, something fanciful and crazy that I just wouldn't make at home. I've been making a whole lot of martinis.
Well, you had mentioned when I spoke to you before the show that we were talking about our, you know, habits have been out to restaurants and this and that. And you said that you were taking advantage of that cocktails to go. Talk about that a little bit.
Oh, I've been doing lots of those. I haven't been comfortable really getting out to bars just yet, but I've been really trying to support bars wherever I can by purchasing cocktails to take home and enjoy there. And it's been amazing to see how many there are. And even seeing outside of the New York area, where obviously I'm not able to travel yet, but I've seen people getting drinks in DC in pouches and calling them, you know, Fauci Pouchies. I mean, people are just so creative putting together cocktail kits and all kinds of, you know, ready-made garnishes. I think one of my favorites, just in terms of presentation, Death & Company was doing drinks to go, and they, I had delivered a Vesper that arrived with a perfect little lemon peel garnish and a perfect little parallelogram. And it just made me happy, you know, pour it into my own glass and garnish it and, you know, transport it when we needed it most.
So it comes, when you get it, it comes separated from, obviously, if it's got something that's carbonated, that's not going to travel well, but it's better to pour it fresh. So you ordered a Vesper, you said?
Yeah, that's vodka, gin, Lillet. And it was pre-mixed and bottled, and it arrived with a really perfect little lemon peel garnish. Huh. And I think it was pre-chilled and everything, and it was lovely. It was nice.
Now, that I can see as a canned drink, definitely. Yeah. The canned drinks, you see a lot of different varieties, but probably just a few companies. Do you see that there are more companies producing these, or is it still, you know, the same few producers?
The canned cocktails? They are exploding. Well, not literally exploding, but
yeah, probably sure they're,
I said that, it's like, well, that's maybe a poor choice of words, but yeah, we're about to have a real aluminum can shortage because there have been so many canned cocktails. I mean, it's just incredible. There's a distillery in LA called Green Bar, and they have transformed. They've converted a big part of their distillery to just be a canned cocktail. I don't know what you call it, not a factory exactly, but
production center.
Yeah, it's like a production facility. Yeah, they're canning cocktails for themselves, for others. They're just really shifting their resources over to do that because demand is so high right now. It's people who are at home, of course, but sales in liquor stores and other venues. And I think as travel opens up, I think it's going to be another huge, huge market. I mean, think about drinking on trains, like Pimm's, you know, my Pimm's on a train. Now it's going to be available here or on, I'm seeing some opening on airplanes. There's I can't remember the brand that just signed on, I believe for Delta Airlines. And in today's day and age, canned cocktails on a plane, perfect is that?
Huge. It is perfect. I want to talk more about that, the trains and the plane, trains, planes, and canned cocktails, right? When we come back, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk about that, the transportation bars. That's interesting. Okay, so stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Forever Cheese. Forever Cheese has been a pioneer in the specialty food industry for over 20 years. They source the most exceptional, authentic, and creative artisan cheese and accompaniments from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia. Every product they carry is thoughtfully hand-selected from their trusted producers in Europe. The standards of Forever Cheese are legendary. Many of their products, including Drunken Goat, Genuine Fulvi Pecorino Romano, Mitica Marcona Almonds, and Fig and Date Cakes, are now integral to today's market. You can learn more about their product lineup at forevercheese.com. Forever Cheese is proud of their role as a trusted authority in the specialty cheese world. Their philosophy is to put passion behind everything they do, from finding the best products to celebrating those who make them. Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Thanks to Forever Cheese for supporting this episode. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Kara Newman, and Kara is a spirits writer, and she also is a recipe developer for drinks, and she gives great demonstrations and mixes a good drink. And Kara, you had just mentioned that one of the canned cocktail, we were talking about the ready-to-drink RTDs, or ready-to-drink cocktails, had signed on with an airlines, but then also train travel. Speaking about that, you know, it's interesting because there's this resurgence of these retro cocktails. You think of the sophisticated cocktail era, you know, and all the fancy cocktail bars, and I just think of somebody with a cigarette holder holding a coupe of, you know, some fancy cocktail in it. Along with the retro cocktails, what sounds like that you've just described is retro drinking habits, or not habits. I hate to say habit, but it is a habit. Retro drinking places, trains. I mean, the bar car in a train, I mean, that was an institution, right? And now planes.
I miss bar car. I miss trains.
So you think we're going back to that kind of society?
I do. I think that it's not going to be the same at all. I mean, I would love it if we went back to, you know, Pullman dining cars, like, you know, in the 1860s. Mm. And I don't see that happening. I mean, they used to have these enormous, you know, even wine lists on the early Pullman menus. There's a great book, Food on the Rails, that's Jerry Quinzio. And she actually published, and that there was a Pullman menu focused on French cuisine, and it listed more than 50 wines, 50.
Wow.
And cocktails like sherry cobblers and punches. And that's kind of the precursor of bar carts. I wish we could bring bar carts back to Amtrak.
Yeah, that would be fun. And the airlines, I mean, they're with the introduction of the so-called jumbo jet back in the late 60s, they had there was a bar built in, and the little upstairs, you went upstairs and there was a bar area. I mean, I don't know if that's going to happen.
I don't know about that. When I was researching road soda, I found there was a 1958 promotional video for Pan Am, and it showed passengers sipping champagne coupes, like you were just talking about, sipping champagne from coupes and sitting in what looked like a spacious living room on board a flight. And I don't think we're ever going to get back to that. I mean, maybe if you're flying some very luxurious high-end airline and you're flying first class, maybe. But I kind of see myself in the future probably sitting in economy plus with a canned cocktail, and I'll be perfectly happy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, you know, I'm of two minds about the cocktail craze. And the first is, you know, what is this need we have? Yeah, we need to celebrate. And cocktails are, as I said, are festive. And it's a way to just sort of feel that, okay, life is fun and everything's okay. And then again, being health conscious and not, you know, and drinking too much. There's always that. We always have to keep that in the back.
Everything
of our minds.
In moderation, of course.
Exactly, in moderation. And I think that cocktails, in a way, keep might keep some people from drinking in moderation, might keep them drinking in moderation, because a cocktail is something you don't want to gulp and shoot down. And, you know, you want to sip it. It's complex and often sweet. So it's something that you want to savor and sip slowly. And I think that, you know, creates a different kind of drinking. Again, the word habit, but, you know, the way in which one consumes is different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, one of the things I really learned during the pandemic, for myself anyway, is that a cocktail is always about more than just a cocktail. And what I really missed was drinking with other people in a social situation. Mm-hmm. And I missed being in bars, because they're like communal living rooms. You're with other people. It's the concept of the third place. You know, you're, the first place is your home. The second place is your workplace. And the third place is some place that's neither work nor home, but it might be
social,
a bar. Right. Exactly. It's social. Yeah. For some people, it's a barber shop. For some people, it's a bookstore. But for me, it's a bar. And I miss having the experience of somebody else making a cocktail for me and consuming it with other people around in an atmosphere that's convivial in some way.
Right. And cocktails are not really designed to be consumed alone. It really is something. I think I agree with you that it's fun to have another person or more people and have a discussion, and really talk. And we all look forward to that. It's something that we can hope that will happen very soon, I'm sure. Anything on the horizon that you can see as far as, well, you mentioned the styles of drinking. There might be some multi-mix cocktails. Wine, I will never lose wine, but wine, of course, meant to be consumed with food, whereas cocktails are just meant for celebration.
They can be entertainment in and of themselves.
Right, right. I like that. Entertainment in and of themselves. Interesting. Well, I knew I could count on you to answer questions as I have to rummage through my liquor cabinet again. I mean, there's some stuff in the back, but I don't know how long it's been there. And I'm sure I'm not sure what it is, but I guess I can always count on you to answer those questions. And next time I run across that bottle of Pimm's, I'll know what to do with it. Right. But you mentioned the Wimbledon tennis tournament, and it became the signature drink, right, of Wimbledon's.
It is. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely one of the best warm weather drinks. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one to try. There are even some bartenders who have been trying to remake the lost Pimm's, like the Pimm's 2, 3, 4, 5. You could try to remake your own, you know, Pimm's number, whatever you like with your Pimm's as the base.
No, so the numbers just signify the different liquor that it's made with, and it's not, so gin is the original and the primary. So what the other numbers are, let's say, you know, like rum or
two
rye.
Is scotch. Hmm. Two is scotch. Three is brandy. Four is rum. Then five, that one was post-war. That one was built on rye, and that was introduced in Canada, where they drink a lot of rye whiskey, and they, for a while, they called all whiskey rye. Hmm. And then number six was vodka. Hmm. And then they stopped giving the numbers.
Well, eventually they're going to run out of mixers. I mean,
yeah. No, yeah. Then they got rid of all of them. And now the only one that's left is one. And sometimes they bring out new flavored variations and they don't have any numbers.
Interesting.
There are things like, mango and passion fruit or cider cup or apple.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see why Wimbledon adopted it as their signature drink. I mean, because it, with all the fruit, it is a real summertime kind of, you know, celebration, because it's packed with fruit.
It's really refreshing too. I mean, if you're going to be sitting outside watching a sporting event, you need something that's not too boozy and, you know, a long drink. that you can nurse for a while. Lots and lots of ice.
Yeah.
And PIMS suits that.
Does anyone really know the ingredients of PIMS?
Well, yes, but it's very limited. It's sort of like chartreuse. There are only two monks who know what is in chartreuse. Supposedly the PIMS recipe is known to six people and six people only.
Oh, okay. All right. I know Campari is one of those two that has a sort of a secretive kind of recipe for the original Campari.
I have a theory. It's all kept top secret so that we won't know that it's actually something very, either very straightforward that we could figure out on our own or something, you know, so chemical based, we would never want to drink it if we knew.
Oh,
so
couldn't taste that good and be that bad. Well, it's always...
I'll go with the first theory.
Yeah, right. Okay. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Kara, and to learn something new about drinking. And I hope that we all get back to our favorite bars and our favorite cocktails mixed by a friendly bartender very soon.
Yes, please.
Thanks for sharing and thanks for listening. Again, this has been another Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.